Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Catch with John Fisher on Blog Talk Radio, connecting life to faith.
World is trying to get it together, trying to help their fellow man, hoping we can make it.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of The Catch on Blog Talk Radio. And we had a guest, but I just lost him somehow. So let me take another shot here at getting him on the line. So hang on. This is fun. I always like calling people live.
Hello.
did I hang up on you or what?
I don't know what happened. I don't know.
That's very weird. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I got you back. Here we are. And I was just telling the people a little bit about you. This is Randall Balmer, ladies and gentlemen. And he is a historian of American religion. One of my more favorite people on the earth, to tell you the truth. There's not too many people who can do what he can do. He is an evangelical believer, but he can talk about evangelicals to the rest of the world in ways that they can get it, they can understand, and he can speak a secular language about faith. And that's why he's been at Columbia University and now at Dartmouth. That's why he has written a ton of books, and his Mine Eyes Has Seen the Glory, a journey into the evangelical subculture in America, which was a PBS series and a fantastic book, and then delving into some of the early movements of churches right after the Jesus movement, and then on through to God in the White House, how faith shaped the presidency from John F. Kennedy to George W. Bush. He's just done a ton of thinking about Christians in America, and well, there's an awful lot to think about because of what's happened in the last 30 years. And we've been really fortunate to have him on our show a couple times. So we are fortunate now to have him back. Randall, welcome back to The Catch on Blog Talk Radio.
I'm delighted to be here, John. Thank you.
You're welcome. Randall, we want to talk about your new book that's coming out early next year, and I hope I have the title right. It's Solemn Reverence, The Separation of Church and State in America. We want to talk about that, an incredible concept that I have a feeling is greatly misunderstood right now, and I'd love to delve into this. You know, I'd love to hear first just a brief description of what is a separation of church and state, and then I really would like to get into what the founding fathers meant when they set this thing up, and where are we now in relationship to it. So this is going to be fascinating.
Let's do it. Yeah. Well, I think the most important thing to remember about separation of church and state in America is that it was a radically new idea in Western culture to configure a government, the new government of the United States, in a way that you did not have the interlocking support of religion or faith. And there are a lot of reasons for that historically. I think one of the biggest reasons was the fact that if you look at the American colonies, that is the what became the 13 original states, and you look at the religious composition of each of these colonies, it was extraordinarily diverse. That is to say, you had, yes, you have Puritans up in New England, Massachusetts, and also in Connecticut. In Rhode Island, you had Baptists. The beginning of the Baptist tradition in America was with Roger Williams in 1631 in Rhode Island. And you go down south from there, you have in New York, or what became New York, the Dutch Reformed Church, but also a whole lot of other religious groups in that area. In New Jersey, you had, again, the Dutch Reformed Church, but you also had Quakers. You also had Presbyterians. And if you go west from there, in Pennsylvania, you had William Penn's Holy Experiment, which was a whole new idea of religious toleration with Quakers, but also all these German groups, Schwenkfelders and Dunkers and Mennonites. And, you know, you just keep going down the list. Maryland, Quaker, you had English Catholics. Down in Virginia, you had Anglicans. In Delaware, by the way, you had Swedish Lutherans. And then in the South, you had the Anglican Church, but you also had a whole lot of folk religious practices. And if you go down to Florida, you had Spanish Catholics. So as the founders were sitting down to configure this new nation, they said, how are we going to deal with religion? And there were spirited debates about this. But what came out of this was the First Amendment, which was drafted by James Madison, and the notion that you could have a government that was not supported or was not supporting any one religious group. And this is, I think, the genius of American life. We in America have a religious culture that is off the charts compared to any other Western nation, even any nation in the world. You look at England, for example, you have a state church, the Church of England. Last I checked, about 3% of the population showed up on Sunday mornings in Anglican churches. And here in America, however, you have this vibrant, salubrious religious culture that is the direct consequence of the founders deciding that there would be no favored religion, no state church. And that, I think, is part of the genius of American life.
Wow. So how is this understood then in the early days of our founding? Did it go well then, or were there difficulties?
There were difficulties, and it would also need to be said that even though the First Amendment had established this notion of the separation of church and state, the individual states at that time had their own ideas, and the last two states to disestablish the religion were Connecticut and Massachusetts. Connecticut in 1818 and Massachusetts in 1833. And there's a wonderful story about this. One of the leading ministers in Connecticut was Lyman Beecher in Litchfield, Connecticut. And as the Connecticut legislature was debating whether or not to initiate a referendum on whether or not the Connecticut church, or that is the Congregational Church in Connecticut, should be disestablished, that is, no longer having state support, Lyman Beecher was just, you know, he was at loose ends. He said, this is the end of morality in Connecticut. It's going to be the worst thing that could happen to religion and faith in Connecticut. And then the citizens of Connecticut, by a narrow margin, actually, voted to disestablish religion in Connecticut. That is, to no longer provide state support for the Congregational Church. 2 years later, Lyman Beecher writes, this is the best thing that ever happened to religion in Connecticut. It was all over the place because no longer is the state involved in religion, in the faith. And he understood this as a wonderful liberation for faith, and it worked. And they happened in Massachusetts.
So why then, why is it so, why is the separation of church and state so important, Randall?
I think it's important. When you look back to the origins of this notion, actually you go back to Roger Williams, who was the founder of the Baptist tradition in America. And Baptists historically, at least until 1979, have been the guardians of this wall of separation between church and state. And Roger Williams wrote in 1644, he said that it was important to separate the garden of the church from the wilderness of the world by means of a wall of separation. That's where the metaphor comes from. And it's important to remember in understanding that language that Roger Williams and other people living in 17th century New England were not members of the Sierra Club. That is, they were not the fanciers of the wilderness. Wilderness for them was a place of darkness where evil lurked. And so when Roger Williams is talking about protecting the garden of the church from the wilderness of the world by means of a wall of separation, what he's primarily concerned about is safeguarding the integrity of the faith from too close an association with the state. And that's a very important point, I think, that gets lost in all these contemporary discussions about church and state in America. Roger Williams understood that the integrity of the faith would be compromised if it was too closely associated with the state.
Okay. Well, how do we understand, this is a big question, probably impossible to answer, but generally, how do you think people understand separation of church and state today? How do they think about it? Is it different from this?
Well, people have, I think it's fair to say people have all sorts of misconceptions about this. You know, some people would say that separation of church and state means that somebody who is an ordained minister, for example, cannot run for public office. Well, that's crazy. That's nonsense. That's not what the founders intended. And in fact, in Article 6, don't quote me on that, the Constitution is very specific about that, is that there is no religious test for holding political office. That's not the case at all. Nor is it the case, I believe, that people of faith need to somehow mute their religious convictions in the arena of public discourse. I don't believe that at all. In fact, I believe that the arena of public discourse would be impoverished without those voices of faith. At the same time, however, I also want to emphasize that I think that the norms and the etiquette of democracy should be observed in any sorts of discussions. That is to say, yes, it's okay for me as a Christian, as an evangelical Christian, to say that on the basis of my beliefs, I should take X position on this matter of public debate. But, I'm fully entitled to do that. But at the same time, the etiquette of democracy means that my voice is only one voice in that arena of public discourse, and that I need to be able to listen to other voices who might be informed by other convictions, including atheist or agnostic convictions, and consider that as well as a legitimate contribution to public discourse.
Right. Right. Well, what are some other misconceptions that we have today about this? Because for the last 30 years, evangelicals have gotten very much involved in politics. And
oh yes,
I have a feeling that a lot of them are wishing to see something that might even be a violation of the separation of church and state. Sure. Am I right?
Well, I think that's right. For example, I was one of the expert witnesses in the Alabama Ten Commandments case. You probably remember that case.
Yes.
Where Roy Moore, who was the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, installed this Ten Commandments monument in the middle of the judicial building. And I was very clear about that. I'm a person of faith, absolutely. Because he insisted on the Ten Commandments and no other religious representations in that space, that represented a violation of the what's called the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. That is to say, that the government should favor no one religious tradition in public life. And so, and my testimony in part was that religion has flourished in America precisely because of the First Amendment and the Establishment Clause. That is to say, the First Amendment, and I use this analogy rather frequently, and have for years, by the way, the First Amendment, it really set up a kind of free marketplace for religion in America, where you have all these religious groups who are competing with one another for popular followings. And that lends an energy and a dynamism and a vitality to religion in America that you just don't see in other parts of the world. The irony to me about Roy Moore is that he claims to be a Baptist. Well, Roger Williams, the founder of the Baptist tradition in America, would be horrified at what Roy Moore tried to do in Alabama. And in fact, the courts, of course, said this is a violation of the First Amendment and it has to be removed. He refused to remove it, and so he was removed from office. It's a rather complicated case and kind of humorous at some level, I think, in some ways.
Yeah.
But again, Roger Williams' concern was that linking the faith to the state or to the government would diminish the faith. And my little postscript to this whole story is that once the court decided that it was, and it was a proper decision, that it represented a violation of the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause, and Judge Thompson ordered it removed, one of the protesters screamed, "Get your hands off my God," as workers were preparing to remove the monument.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, John, one of those commandments says something about a graven image. And that, again, was precisely Roger Williams' point, that if you commingle church and state, you will eventually fetishize and trivialize the faith. And I think the whole caper, the whole Royce Rock caper, illustrates that point beautifully.
So what is that guy who's crying out there? Because I think he represents a lot of Christians the way they think today, like prayer in schools and like you say, the Ten Commandments.
What do they
understand, and where does that come from?
Well, let's talk about that. All right, prayer in schools. First of all, the Supreme Court never outlawed prayer in schools. One of my heroes, and I expect one of yours, is the late Republican senator from Oregon, Mark Hatfield.
Yes.
An evangelical Christian, a good Baptist, a strong believer. And he went onto the floor of the Senate one time. Actually, I was in town that day when he did it. And he said, nobody ever said that I can't pray in school. I prayed in school constantly, especially before math tests. Nobody's saying you can't pray in school. The issue is public prayer in public schools. And then if you start to say, okay, let's talk through this whole process. If you're going to have public prayer in public schools, who's going to be doing the praying? Who's writing the prayer? I actually heard some religious right people. I was at a conference one time up at Gordon College, and they said, well, on Monday, we're going to have a Christian prayer. On Tuesday, we're going to have a Jewish prayer. On Wednesday, we're going to have a Hindu prayer, and so forth. And I thought, you got to be kidding. I mean, this talk about a way to trivialize and diminish the faith. This, again, circles back to Roger Williams' concern about protecting the garden of the church from the wilderness of the world. I mean, nothing would be more diminishing to the faith, in my judgment, than to have that sort of parade of prayers in public schools. And again, the Supreme Court never said that students can't pray in school. The issue is public prayer, prescribed prayer in public schools. And if you think about it, I think, and I expect even your audience, I hope they would understand that this is not a good thing for the integrity of the faith.
Yeah. Wow. So, but where does that thinking come from, Randall?
It's sloganeering, John. I mean, it's saying, okay, we're taking God out of the public schools. Well, that's just nonsense. I'm sorry, that's not true. People can pray, and again, you know, evangelicals, Protestants understand prayer as this intimate conversation with God, not something that is reduced to formulas or rote prayer. And I just don't see this as an issue that people should be exercised about. I understand they might be, but I think it derives from a misunderstanding of the entire issue.
Is there any hope for setting this thing straight? And positive about this?
Well, I think part of the issue, part of the problem is that you have a lot of people who are, frankly, kind of fashioning careers out of misinformation and misrepresentation of this. I mean, you have people around saying, and the United States is a Christian nation. It was founded as a Christian nation. Well, that's just demonstrably false. It was not founded as a Christian nation. Some of the founders were Christian, yes, but actually they were a minority. I mean, the key founders were actually deists. Benjamin Franklin would never be considered a Christian. He would never be allowed to be a member of any evangelical church that I know of. And there's a lot of misleading misinformation out there, and people are making, as I say, fashioning entire careers out of putting forward very, very false information, and I think that's really unfortunate.
How can we best combat that kind of thinking?
Well, I think it's important that people be historically informed, I think, and understand, again, I make this statement frequently. The First Amendment is the best friend that faith has ever had, at least in American life, in that it has created for us or allowed for us Americans to have a very, very vibrant and salubrious religious culture. And trying to whittle away at that by advocating prescribed prayers in public schools and even the Ten Commandments in public places. Now, people will say, well, wait a minute, you got the Ten Commandments on the Supreme Court. Yes, you do. But you also have the Code of Hammurabi. You also have other representations as the foundations for American law. And understanding the Ten Commandments in that context is a very different thing from posting them in public places. Now, Roy Moore, and I said this at the time, I mean, he's perfectly free as long as he can convince the local zoning officials to put the Ten Commandments in his front yard. Nobody's going to object to that. But public places, that's another matter. And it's a violation of the First Amendment and the separation of church and state.
Hmm. What does it mean, Randall, to have your faith inform your politics? That's got to be tough for some in some areas.
Sure.
What I'm thinking of is, go ahead and answer the first question. And then
I think certainly. I mean, my faith certainly informs my politics. Jesus is pretty clear in Matthew 25 about the responsibility of his followers to our fellow citizens, and he instructed us to care for the least of these. And this certainly has political implications, it seems to me, in terms of public policy, health care, care for the poor, providing for the needs of those who are unable to support themselves for one reason or another. I think that has enormous implications. You look at the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, and also the New Testament, Jesus tells us to welcome the stranger, to treat the foreigner as one of our own. That mm-hmm. certainly has implications for immigration policy these days. The whole issue in Christian tradition, the tradition of just war, when is it legalized or morally justified to wage war? And there's been centuries of thinking about this from a Christian perspective. And I think that any public servant, whether he be president of the United States or a state legislator or a member of a local town council, needs mm-hmm. to be aware of these things. And those principles should inform how he or she conducts public policy.
I've been thinking lately about a politician is a representative of the people. The people elect
yes.
him or her, and but then a politician will have their own belief system. What does a politician do when their beliefs are in conflict with the majority of the people who put them in office, what they want to see?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, I coming back to Mark Hatfield, a person I greatly admire, he was very much out of step with many of his constituents in his very early opposition to the war in Vietnam. But mm-hmm. he understood that as a matter of conscience, and he stuck to his conscience. There was actually another example later in his career. You remember in 1994, Newt Gingrich ran was able to elect a majority of Republicans to the House of Representatives with his contract with America, which included a support for a balanced budget amendment. And it was passed the House, came to the Senate, and the Republicans were in control of the Senate, and they needed Mark Hatfield's vote to pass that legislation. He thought it was morally wrong. I think he's absolutely right about that, by the way. And he actually offered to resign his seat. He went to the majority leader, Robert Dole, and said, I'll resign my seat, but I cannot violate my conscience. And Dole rightly said, no, don't do that, Mark. We need you here in the Senate because you're the conscience of the Senate in many respects. So he to me is an exemplar, a kind of hero of that sort of taking the stand for conscience.
Okay. Do you think they ever have to go against their conscience because of the people they represent? Does that ever happen?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think principles are much more important than that. And there have been examples of various politicians who have voted their conscience and then were voted out of office, but they also understood that as the price for being faithful to their convictions. Mm-hmm. Not an easy choice, I'm sure.
So that's why it's good for a politician to make that clear in the beginning before they're elected.
I would think so. Yeah, I would think so. Yes, you know, this is where I stand. These are this is my moral compass, and I think we have, you know, if I may say so, we have far too few politicians these days who are willing to live according to a moral compass.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Well, I knew this was going to go fast, and it did. And time is basically up. I just think I want to say in conclusion here about that the whole idea of setting people free to come to their own conclusions about things. And I think what we need to realize as Christians is that that's a better environment for real faith than to somehow put constraints on people in terms of what they are going to believe or do.
I think that's right, and I think American history has borne that out, the wisdom of that decision. And again, I want to emphasize that the whole notion of the First Amendment and the separation of church and state was a radical idea at the time. Europe had never tried something like that. And I think the experiment, 200 plus years into that experiment, shows that it's worked out pretty well.
Great. Well, I wish that somehow everybody could get a hold of your book. Are you good?
Oh, I do too. I assure you.
Boy, it's great. If you know, so at least those who are hearing my voice right now can look into this further and be a proponent for the kind of thing that I think really helped to set people free. And I think too, even on a personal level, we need to have environment when we're talking with non-Christians to allow them to think what they think and believe what they believe and come to the conclusions on their own as we walk and talk. I think that's part of how we learn to offer grace to people. I don't know. Do you agree with that?
And that's I do, and that's following the example of Jesus, I think, and that's what we're all that's what we all aspire to.
Yeah. Well, Randall, thank you so much, and I'm sure this isn't the last time we'll have you on. Because it's just so great to have your thoughts. And so I pray blessings on your work and just keep it up. And this is great.
Thank you, John. God bless.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, there you go, folks. Some great thinking on Church and State. Freedom. Remember that freedom is the value to pay in terms of people's lives, the position of Christ, or against Christ. You gotta make their own mind. And that's the way it works. That's the way it works. But, huh? Okay. God bless you all. Thanks for listening in. And we will see you next week. Okay? For another episode. Good. Trust you. God bless.